Good evening. If you have your Bibles with you, turn to the book of Numbers, chapter 22. Numbers chapter 22, that's where we're going to spend the bulk of our time tonight. Numbers 22, while I fold up this microphone cord. While you're turning there, I'd like to just take a moment to express my deep appreciation for your prayers, your texts, your calls of encouragement while I was away at the border. Just got back from there on Friday, and like I said, many of you called or you texted me and said, hey, I'm praying for you, praying for your safety. So I appreciate that. And God answered those prayers. I can tell you some stories, and I will tell you a few stories here in just a second from the border. But I also appreciate you checking in on Amanda and the girls. They appreciate that. Just want you to know that we feel and appreciate the love of this Christian family, and we're just so thankful to be here. If you'll indulge me just a moment, I'd kind of like to stray off the path for just a second tonight and talk about the border. To let you know some of the things that I've seen, some of the things that are going on, some of the problems that are facing our nation, and then also some of the problems that are facing the souls that are trying to come into our country. Many of you may or may not be aware, but there are sections of border walls along our Texas-Mexico border. This is a picture from one of them. And this one is in the area that I was patrolling this last week. I usually, when I'm down there, we're on boats. I'm with some game wardens, and we're assigned a sector, and we go and we patrol that sector for the day. Well, one morning as we were out, we were passing this section of border, and you can see it's constructed of these galvanized pipe. They're probably, I don't know, 9 inches to a foot in diameter. They're about 20 feet tall, and basically they're concreted into the ground. You can see the big heavy equipment putting it up there. But they're set in a way that they're close enough together that no human can just pass through the space that's there. And they go for long stretches. Some of them are miles long. They're not along the entire border, but there are sections like this that you see here. In fact, this is the section we were near during the story I'm about to tell you. One morning we were trolling out to our sector, and I saw a couple of the other boats in front of us kind of stopping. And what had happened was one of our fellow officers had located a 20-year-old young lady who was on the U.S. side, not the Mexican side. The Mexican side would be the side nearest the river. She was on the U.S. side, sitting on the ground. And as he went by, he noticed that she did not get up. She didn't try to run, which is typically what those who come across do. They try to run from us and get away. She just sat there. And so he went and made contact with her. And he came to find out that she had crossed over in the night with a group. And after scaling that 20-foot wall, she fell. And she broke both her legs. And there she sat, broken, scared, in a foreign country, not really knowing what the next move was. But there she sat. No one in her group was anywhere to be found. 20 years old. Didn't speak the language. The next day, we had some heavy rain, and we actually found the body of a man who had drowned trying to cross the Rio Grande River. And so I tell you these stories, again, have nothing to do with the lesson tonight, but I want to relate to you the fact that this is happening. I mean, people are coming over, and I'm not trying to get political with you or anything like that. I think we need to secure our borders. We do have people that are coming in that are bringing bad things like drugs, and they're trafficking humans, they're trafficking children. So those things all need to be stopped. But mainly I tell you those stories so that you will consider these people, these neighbors of ours to the south, and consider what they're running from. Consider what it would take for a 20-year-old girl to, in the middle of the night, cross a river, climb a wall, only to break her legs. What she's risking, what she must be running from in order for her to take that risk. I implore you to pray for these people. They're our neighbors to the south. We're Christians. Let's pray for them. I'm not going to go on any more on that. I want to move into the lesson, but I did want you to know some of the things that are going on down there. Thank you again for your prayers, and thank you for checking in on my family. There is a phrase that has become common in our culture. In fact, I heard it today. We went out to eat, and some of the waitresses were kind of sitting around, and they were setting up their silverware. They were kind of rolling them up and rolling the napkins, and one of them said, it is what it is. And I've heard this phrase used in the business world, typically when someone is facing a challenge or a frustrating situation that they believe there's no way out. There's no way to change that situation, and it must be accepted. They'll just say, it is what it is. For instance, one time I had a supervisor who delivered the bad news to a group of teachers that their insurance premiums were going up. And he ended that meeting kind of like this. He said, you know, I know you don't like this news. I don't like it either. But this came from above my head. And I can't change it. So it is what it is. A lot of times it's used as an excuse to shirk off responsibility or to avoid complaints or confrontation. Sometimes it's used to avoid challenges or difficult tasks. I heard of a college student who was getting ready and debating with himself whether or not to study all night for that test the next morning. And he said to himself, I could stay up all night studying, but, you know, if I don't know it by now, I'm probably not going to know it in the morning, so it is what it is. I'm going to sleep. And the basic idea of the phrase is that this is the way it is. You may not like it, but you cannot change it, so accept it and move on. The phrase passes responsibility from the person saying it to someone else, usually with more authority, and it squashes any idea of change or arguments, and it really leaves the hearer feeling powerless so that they come away just accepting whatever it is. And while this phrase is not found in the Bible, there is a similar phrase that I thought of that is related to this phrase, and it was actually used whenever God spoke to Moses in Exodus chapter 3. You'll remember the story of the burning bush, and God tells Moses, you're going to be my man. You're going to be the one who goes to Israel and delivers them out of the land of Egypt. And at one point, Moses says to God, suppose they ask me who sent me, what should I tell them? And God says, tell them I am who I am. And while this phrase is not, it is what it is an ultimate statement of authority. I am God, and I am your God. I am the God who's going to deliver you from the hands of the Egyptians. And this ultimate just, this says that he has all authority and it can't be argued with. Well, recently, I was reading the book of Numbers, and I came across the story of Balaam. And Balaam, while he doesn't use the phrase, I am who I am, or God is who God is, he certainly portrayed this idea when he answered Balak, king of Moab. If you'll remember that story, we're going to read in a second, but Balak came and asked Balaam to curse Israel. He said, I want you to curse these people so that I can defeat them in battle. And Balak answered him in not so many words and so many times. He said, I could not go beyond the command of the Lord my God to do less or more. God is who God is. I can't operate outside what he will allow. So here we are in Numbers chapter 22. I want to read this story with you. And then we'll make a few points out of it and the lesson will be yours tonight. Numbers chapter 22. Beginning in verse 1. And just to bring us all to the same page here, in Israel's history, Israel has exited Egypt. They have wandered in the wilderness. They have sent spies to Canaan already. Those spies have come back with a bad report. So another 40 years in the wilderness. And now they're getting close. They're camping in the land, or not the land, but in the the lowlands of Moab, the valley of Moab, and they come in and Balak, the king of Moab, sees them. So here we are in verse 1. Then the people of Israel set out and camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan at Jericho. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was in great dread of the people because they were many. Moab was overcome with fear of the people of Israel. And Moab said to the elders of Midian, "This horde will now lick up all that is around us as the ox licks up the grass of the field." So Balak, the son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at the time, sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the people of Amal, to call him, saying, "Behold, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth, and they are dwelling opposite me. Come now, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the fees of divination in their hand. And they came to Balaam and gave him Balak's message. And he said to them, "Lodge here tonight, and I will bring back word to you as the Lord speaks to me." So the princes of Moab stayed with Balaam. And God came to Balaam and said, "Who are these men with you?" And Balaam said, said to God, "Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent to me, saying, 'Behold, a people has come out of Egypt, and it covers the face of the earth. Now come, curse them for me. Perhaps I shall be able to fight against them and drive them out.' God answered Balaam and said, 'You shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed.' So Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, 'Go to your own land, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you.' So the princes of Moab rose and went to Balak and said, 'Balaam refuses to come with us.' Once again, Balak sent princes, this time more in number and more honorable than these before. And they came to Balaam and said to him, 'Thus says Balak the son of Zippor, let nothing hinder you from coming to me, for I will surely do you great honor in whatever you say to me, I will do. Come curse this people for me.' But Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, 'Though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the command of the Lord my God to do less or more. So you too, please stay here tonight, that I may know what more the Lord will say to me.' And God came to Balaam at night and said to him, 'If the men have come to call you, rise, go with them, but only do what I tell you.' So Balaam rose in the morning, and he saddled his donkey, and he went with the princes of Moab. But God's anger was kindled because he went, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as his adversary. Now he was riding on the donkey, and his two servants were with him. And the donkey saw the angel of the Lord in the road with a drawn sword in his hand, and the donkey turned aside out of the road and went into the field. And Balaam struck the donkey to turn her into the road. Then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path between the vineyards with a wall on either side. And then the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, and she pushed against the wall and pressed Balaam's foot against the wall. So he struck her again. Then the angel of the Lord went ahead and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right or to the left. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. And Balaam's anger was kindled, and he struck the donkey with his staff. Then the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, 'What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?' And Balaam said to the donkey, 'Because you have made me a fool. I wish I had a sword in my hand, for then I would kill you.' And the donkey said to Balaam, 'Am I not your donkey on which you have ridden all your life long to this day? Is it my habit to treat you this way?' And he answered, 'No.' Then the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, and he bowed down and fell on his face. And the angel of the Lord said to him, 'Why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I have come to oppose you because your way is perverse before me. The donkey saw me and turned aside before me these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, surely now I would have killed you and let her live.' Then Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, 'I have sinned, for I did not know that you stood in the road against me. Now, therefore, if it is evil in your sight, I will turn back.' And the angel of the Lord said to Balaam, 'Go with the men, but speak only the word that I tell you.' So Balaam went on the went on with the princes of Balak. When Balak heard that Balaam had come, he went out to meet him at the city of Moab, on the border formed by the Arnon at the extremity of the border. And Balak said to Balaam, "Did I not send to you to call you? Why did you not come to me? Am I not able to honor you?" Balaam said to Balak, "Behold, I have come to you. Have I now any power of my own to speak anything? The word that God puts in my mouth, that I must speak." And we're going to stop our reading there. We're not going to read the rest of the interaction between Balaam and Balak, but I am going to summarize that for you. In the next two chapters, 23 and 24, Balaam goes with Balak, and he takes him up to high places where he can see a portion of the people, and he offers sacrifices to God, and then he asks Balaam to go curse the people. Every time, Balaam goes, and he speaks the oracles of God, which are all blessings on the Israelite people, which frustrates Balak because he's asking him for curses. And but after he does that three times, Balaam delivers one final oracle which tells of the destruction of Moab. He prophesies that, "Balak, your people and you are going to be crushed and you're going to be gone." And after that, with Balak mad at him, they part ways. Balaam goes back to his place and Balak goes back to his. We don't know just a whole lot about Balaam prior to Numbers chapter 22. It's believed that he was not tied to the Israelite nation. We know that he was a prophet or diviner of sorts, and apparently he had a good reputation as that. We heard Balak say that those whom you bless are blessed and those whom you curse are cursed. So we know that he had a good reputation. We also know that Balaam believed in Yahweh God. He says in that reading that we just read that the Lord, he refers to God as the Lord my God. And so we can assume that Balaam had a relationship with God of some sort, and that he had previously interacted with God, because when these messengers come from Balak, he says, "Hold on a second, let me go check with God and we'll go from there." So if you were to stop here, if you weren't to study any more about Balaam, you might come away kind of like I did after this last time. And I said, you know, that Balaam, he's not that bad of a guy. I kind of like him. He believes God. He stands up. He says what God tells him to say. And he did some things right. And so let's look at a second for the things that he got right. First of all is this. He acknowledged God's authority and power. Back in our reading in verse 8 there, again, when the people came to him, when the servants from Balak came and the princes, he said, "Stay here tonight, I'm going to go check with the Lord and I'll bring back word to you." So his initial thought whenever these men come to him is to go ask God. Then in verse 13, he goes to him and says, "You know what, I can't go. The Lord said I can't go. I operate in this realm. There's only certain things I can do. I have to stay within God's power. I can't go with you." Then in verse 18, he says, "I cannot go beyond the command of the Lord my God to do less or more." Balaam believed that God had power. He knew that God had power, and he knew that God controlled the realm he could work in. He knew that he couldn't bless someone without God's approval, and he couldn't curse someone without God's approval. Secondly, he spoke what God told him to speak. In 22:38, it said, "The word that God puts in my mouth, that I must speak." Then after he starts speaking these oracles of God, and Balak is getting mad at him, he says, "Must I not take care to speak what the Lord puts in my mouth?" In chapter 23, verse 26, Balaam said, "Did I not tell you all that the Lord says I must do?" And then finally in chapter 24, he says in verse 13, "I would not be able to go beyond the word of the Lord to do either good or bad of my own will. What the Lord speaks, that will I speak." And so Balaam has this boldness to stand up to even a powerful king. And speak exactly what the Lord tells him to speak. And finally, Balaam got right that he confessed his sin. When he was confronted by that angel in chapter 22, he admits, he says, "I've sinned. I didn't know you were standing there. If this is evil, if this path is evil, then I'll turn from it. And again, if we were to stop here, we'd probably go away thinking, man, Balaam is a pretty good guy. Like he believes God, he stands up for it, and even when he does things wrong, he confesses that sin. But the New Testament and further on in Numbers, we learn about the end of Balaam. And so we need to study what Balaam got wrong. First of all, Balaam pursued a path that he knew was against God's will. How do we know that? Well, what did God tell him the first time he asked? God said in chapter 22, verse 12, "You shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed." That should have been the end of the story. But what happened? Well, Balak sent more princes, more in number, more promises. He basically said, "Hey, Balaam, I got a blank check here with your name on it. Anything you want, I'll give you." And so, again, Balaam probably should have said then, "Look, God has already said no. This ain't going to happen. You might as well go back." But instead, he goes to God again, and this time God reluctantly says, "Okay. Parents, you've experienced this. You've experienced this with your kids. They come and they're like, hey, I want to do this. I want to do this." And you're like, "I know better. You're not going to do this." And they just keep nagging you. And eventually you're like, "Yeah, you can go do whatever it is. You can have the candy bar." And that's kind of what I think happened here. He's nagging God about this. He wants his will. He wants the earthly blessings. Turn with me, if you will, to 2 Peter chapter 2 for just a second. We read about Balaam in 2 Peter chapter 2. In this text about false prophets, Simon Peter writes, describing false prophets in verse 15, it says, "Forsaking the right way, they have gone astray. They have followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved gain from wrongdoing, but was rebuked for his own transgression. A speechless donkey spoke with human voice and restrained the prophet's madness." Here we clearly see Balaam's motive. He wasn't about God's business. He wanted to go with Balak. He wanted to fill out that blank check, and that's why he was going. That's why he didn't say no from the get-go. Secondly, he failed to see the signs that God had placed in front of him. Not only did he ignore God when he said no the first time, and not only did he ignore the fact that God reluctantly said, "You can go," then you got this whole donkey business. You got the angel standing in front of him. He doesn't see the angel. And first the donkey tries to run into a field. Then he tries to run into a narrow path between the vineyards with a wall on either side. Then he presses his foot against the wall, crushing his foot. And of course, Balaam's just taking it out on the donkey the whole time. He walks into a narrow place, and then finally the donkey just lays down. And then the donkey speaks. And I was talking with BJ about this earlier, and BJ said, "You know, the craziest part about that story is even when the donkey's talking to him, he still doesn't get it." And so here this donkey's speaking to him, and what does he do? He's arguing with the donkey. He's like, "You've made me a fool. If I had a sword now, I'd kill you." He's arguing with the donkey. He doesn't realize that he has sinned until he actually has his eyes opened by God, and he sees the angel. And only then does he say, "I've sinned." So he failed to see the signs that God was placing right in front of him. And worst of all, he just did not learn from his mistakes. Turn to Numbers chapter 31 with me. Once Balaam leaves Balak, once he gives that final oracle and tells Balak that your end is destruction, they leave, they part ways, and we really don't hear much more of Balaam until we get to chapter 31. And in the beginning of chapter 31, in verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, avenge the people of Israel on the Midianites. Afterward, you shall be gathered to your people. So God is telling Moses, it's time to start going to war. And he wants them to go avenge with Midian and Moab and some of these other places. We read in verse 16. This is talking about they've gone, they've killed, and they bring back some of the women. And it says, behold, these, talking about the women, on Balaam's advice, caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against the Lord in the incident of Peor. And so plague came among the congregation of the Lord. So what we do know about Balaam and what happened to him once he parted ways with Balak is that he didn't learn from what was told to him by God. Here we had him prophesying the very words that destruction is coming to their land, and he goes back to that land, he dwells in it, he gives advice to the people of Moab that, hey, if you will get these foreign women over into Israel, and if you'll get these foreign gods over into Israel, it'll be their downfall. And his final ultimately he is found dwelling among the people. If you go back up to verse 8, actually starting in verse 7, it says, they warred against Midian as the Lord commanded Moses and killed every male. They killed the kings of Midian with the rest of their slain, Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba, the five kings of Midian. And they also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. He had all this knowledge. He had this belief. He had a strong belief that he operated within the realm of God. He had a belief in God's power. He had foreknowledge that this war was coming, and yet he didn't do anything about it. He just stayed there, and he fought against the Israelite army. He didn't learn from his mistakes. And so with that, and with this story, I found myself relating to Balaam more than I ever had before. I know we learned that story in Bible class, and it's kind of funny because the donkey and everything. But again, when I read this story this last time, I thought, man, Balaam, he's really not that bad of a guy. But I want to take away some lessons from Balaam, and I want to do that by asking a few questions. And the first one is this. Do you believe and submit to God's authority and power? And so when you consider your daily walk, as you go to work, as you go to school, as you interact with people of all walks of life, from rich to poor, from powerful to powerless, are you submitting to God? Are you boasting about God? I think of the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel chapter 3. You remember that story? You don't have to turn there necessarily, but you remember that story? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are in the land of King Nebuchadnezzar. And King Nebuchadnezzar he's set up these idols. And every time the trumpet blows, he has the whole nation bow and worship these idols. And of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, being God-fearing, God-believing people, they say, no, we're not going to do that. God won't allow for that, and we're not going to do it. And so King Nebuchadnezzar gets word of this, and he calls them up and he says, look, guys, I'm going to give you one more chance. The next time this trumpet blows, you bow down, you worship, we'll be good. Nothing will happen to you. But if you don't, you're going into a fiery furnace. And do you remember their response? Ah, it's so good. They said, we have no need to answer you, O king, because our God is able to deliver us. Now, had God told them that he was going to deliver them? I don't think so. They just had this belief that God was able to deliver them. And that story reminds me that we serve a powerful God. And Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego believed that even if he tossed them in there, he was able to save them. And we serve that same God, and that God loves you. And he has a plan for your life. His eye is on you, just like we sang, his eye is on the sparrow. There was a movie that came out in 2003 called Big Fish. It's kind of a good movie. In the early part of that movie, the story follows three kind of middle school-aged boys in this sleepy little town. And the boys hear a rumor of a witch that lives on the edge of that town in this old rickety house. And the rumor is that if they go look into the witch's eye, she's got a glass eye, if they go look into her eye, they can see how they will die. And so they do this. They wait late one night, and they go, and they knock on the witch's door, and they go up, and they all take turns looking in her eye. One of them looks in, and he says, "I saw when I die, and I'm really young." And so he gets scared, and he runs away. The second says, I died kind of middle age. And then the third one, he said, "You know what? I died when I'm really old." And so the story follows that third one as he goes on through his life. And knowing that he's not going to die young, it caused him to live a very bold life. He's seen doing daredevil stunts. He picks fights with the town bullies. He's kind of town hero. And he's doing all this because he knows his future is not death. He's going to live a long time. And while that's a fictional story and an impossible situation, can I say that we serve a God who knows the day we are going to die? And we serve a God who is able to empower a shepherd boy to take down a giant with one stone. And just the thought of that gives me strength and courage to do things that I cannot do on my own. It encourages me to live boldly. And it comforts me to know that I serve the one and true living God, the God who is God. And He is all the authority and power. He is controlling my life. And so no matter who stands against me, or no matter what sort of obstacles I face, as long as God is on my side, so be it. And if God's will for me is to die, then I'll die. But I know where I'm going after that. What about in your decisions? Are you acknowledging God's power? Are you seeking God's authority in your decisions? I think of the story in Acts chapter 5 of Gamaliel. If you want to turn there, we'll read a couple verses real quick. Acts chapter 5. You all know this is the time of the early church, and the apostles have been preaching in Jerusalem. And about verse 33 says, "When they heard this, they were enraged and wanted to kill them." This is talking about the Pharisees and the Pharisee council wanting to kill the apostles. "But a Pharisee in the council named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law held in honor by all people, stood up and gave orders to put the men outside for a little while. And he said to them, 'Men of Israel, take care what you are about to do with these men. For before these days, Theudas rose up, claiming to be somebody, and a number of men, about 400, joined him. He was killed, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After him, Judas the Galilean rose up in the days of the census and drew away some of the people after him. He too perished, and all who followed were scattered. So in this present case, I tell you, keep away from these men and let them alone. For if this is the plan, if this plan or this undertaking is of man, it will fail. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them. You might even be found opposing God.'" I read that story and I think, where am I there? Am I opposing God in some of my decisions? Am I for God? Is God for me? And I just want to be someone who's constantly about seeking God. Do you recognize when God is intervening in your life? Do you ask for wisdom from God and then seek it through His Word? Do you ask for prayers of wisdom? I'm reminded of what it says in James chapter 5, that the prayer of the righteous avails much. And if you'll remember the donkey, remember what the donkey said? She said, "Am I not your donkey who you've ridden on your whole life long to this day? Is this my habit to treat you this way?" The donkey was trying to relate. She's trying to say, "Look, I've been here the whole time. Have I ever done anything like this to you?" And he's like, "No, you haven't." He should have trusted that donkey. And so I ask, do you trust the people of God that He has put in your life? Children, do you trust your parents? Do you trust that they may see things in your life that you may not see? They may see an angel standing in your path. And they may be able to direct you another way to go. Do you see that? Do you trust them? Husbands, do you trust your wives? I can tell you lots of stories. I won't, because we'd be here all night, of times where I probably should have listened to that blonde-haired lady over there, and I just didn't. But she's got wisdom, and she prays, and she asks for guidance for me, and a lot of times her advice is so good, and I just have to take it. Church, do you trust our elders? Do you trust when they come to you with a problem, or they come to you with a concern? Do you trust that they're looking out for your best interests? If you'll pardon a personal story, recently I'd asked for some prayers from some guys here, some brothers here, about a career decision that I was considering. And I won't go deep into the details, but basically, if I pursued the path of change, it meant more money, but it meant less time with my family, and it meant possibly less time at worship, and it possibly meant a move. So I asked my brothers to pray about this decision, and they've been praying, and I've been praying and looking for God's answer. And the last few times that I was up there teaching in the high school class, when I came in to get ready for the class at night, there was a verse written on the board from 1 Timothy chapter 6. Verse 6 said, "But godliness with contentment is great gain." Now, I don't know who wrote that up there. I don't know if it was one of these brothers. I don't know if it was an angel. I know this. I know we were the only ones using that classroom, just us high school group. And I know I erased it one time, and then the very next time I came in the classroom, it's up there again. So take that for what you will. Is God trying to help direct my path? I believe so. And I think he's using my brothers, maybe an angel, to do that. The donkey saw that angel standing with that sword long before Balaam ever did. And so again, do you think there are people around you? Do you think there are brothers and sisters who are around you who love you and are trying to say, "Hey, there's an angel standing in your path"? And do you act on that? Do you listen to them? Do you adjust your path based on their feedback? Finally, are you seeking God's will or your own? Balaam's problem was not that he didn't know God. It wasn't that he didn't believe God. It wasn't even that he didn't do what God expected of him. He said exactly what God told him to say. Balaam's problem was that he didn't love God more than he loved himself. Balaam wanted to go his own way, and he was so blinded by his own fleshly desires for riches and wealth that he didn't see his trusted donkey trying to stop him, and he didn't see that angel standing in the road. He didn't seek God first. Where do you find yourself tonight? I hope and I pray that we are like Balaam in some ways. I hope that we believe that God is powerful. I hope that we believe that God is active in our lives. He is watching out for us. That He loves us. That He's placing people in your life to help guide you along His path for you. I hope we all believe that. And I hope we can put ourselves out of the way. I hope we can get out of our own way and just allow God's will to become our will. I'm trying to do that. I hope you try to do that too. Where do you find yourself with God tonight? Do you need to be baptized for the remission of sins? Do you need to start your walk with Jesus tonight? Do you need the prayers of this congregation for some sin in your life? Do you need help? If you do, please make it known as together we stand and as we sing.